Slam the bell, sucker!
This is Movie Fighters, the show where Chris Sims and I, Matt Wilson, your hosts, we watch movies and beat them up. And this is it, everybody. The last entry in our series of pulp-themed movies. We've had some ups and some downs.
Oh boy, have we had some downs.
Last episode, we had a big down with The Shadow. And we're hoping that our episode this week, the movie we're watching this week, 1996's The Phantom, starring Billy Zane, will pick us back up. Now, Chris, what do you remember about The Phantom from 1996?
Well, once again, this was one of those movies like The Shadow, like Dick Tracy, that I was like really hyped for because I don't learn my lesson. I never learned my lesson. And I remember seeing it and again being very disappointed. Although, as an adult, I am a pretty big Billy Zane guy.
Yeah, we are Zaniacs. And I don't know if it's like an ironic Twitter thing or like this real late era appreciation for Billy Zane that has jumped up in recent years. But man, I get psyched for Zane anytime he shows up anywhere.
I think what it is Zoolander. Like, Zoolander is the turning point where you're like, Billy Zane.
I guess so. I think he's a great villain.
Oh, he's the best part of Titanic.
Easily. Yeah. He's one of the most likable.
Not his character. His character is reprehensible. But, like, as an actor, like, he's fantastic in Titanic.
Yes. That's how I meant it. But I don't know. I remember watching this movie right after it came out on VHS, because this is when VHS was still a thing.
Right.
With my brother.
Did you get it on a Friday night from Blockbuster?
I do not remember how my brother Brian and I acquired it to watch. I assume we rented it somewhere, because we don't own it. So we watched The Phantom. We just decided that this was what we were going to watch one evening. And we were just really confused by it more than anything, because there's this part, and I'm sure we'll talk about it when we talk about the movie, but it's the number one thing I remember from watching it. About 15 minutes in, halfway through the first act-ish, there's just this moment where this text comes up on the screen that says, "In case you just came in."
Is there really?
Yeah.
See, I remember nothing about the actual movie. I know I saw it. I know that I was a little bit disappointed in it. But I do, like, if you asked me what happened in this movie, the only thing I remember about it is stuff that I read, like, during the making of. Because, again, I think this is one that I had the official movie magazine for, and they talked about how cool it was that Madonna's costume designer designed the Phantom's costume, which, if you know what the Phantom looks like, is not a difficult costume to design.
I mean, he does look accurate to the designs of the Phantom from the many comics appearances of the Phantom. Like, it's a pretty good costume.
Well, they added a bunch of, like, there's, like, patterning in it that's a slightly darker purple. So, like, there's, like, big skull patterns, like, in what he wears, which is kind of cool. But yeah, also, like, it makes it look like a movie costume and not a cosplay costume is what it does.
Well, okay, so the thing about the in case you just came in thing, that is supposed to be a reference to old movie serials, where you might go to a movie and see the third part of a serial and not know what happened. Or there was just a lot more, like, in like the 30s and 40s, there were a lot more instances of people just, like, coming into a movie late. Because it wasn't like, you know, you were paying $12 for a ticket. You were paying 10 cents for a movie ticket. So who cares if you're half an hour late into the movie, right?
Yeah, I mean, I remember there being a big deal when Hitchcock wouldn't let people, like, you had to be in the theater before Psycho started.
Yeah.
And there was a thing that, in response to that, that William Castle did, where you were given the option to leave before the final act of one of his movies began. And so what people would do is they would just sit through two showings and leave during the fright break and get their money back.
So that's an in-joke. That is an in-joke for very old people who, or people who are kind of students of old movies. It's like a joke for them. It makes even less sense when you're watching it on home video, though, right? Like, maybe if it, I was in a theater, I would kind of get it. But because we were watching it on home video, we were just like, what does that mean? And I feel like that is indicative of this movie as a whole. Like, I feel like it's kind of a clever take on pulp and old movies and stuff like that. But for modern audiences in the mid to late 90s, it's just kind of confusing and maybe a little boring.
Well, I think what it is that everybody looks at Raiders of the Lost Ark and Star Wars, which are, you know, the two, like, first of all, two of the most successful movies of all time. You know, two of the most profitable movies of all time, and, like, critically successful as well. And the big thing about Raiders and the big thing about Star Wars is that they're both trying to echo the pulps, right? Echo the serials. Like, Star Wars opens with the weird Episode 4 crawl, which would later become a whole thing, but, you know, is originally just intended to go like, hey, some stuff happened before this, some stuff is going to happen after this. This is right. A serial. Right. You know, Raiders is structured in that series of set pieces. So I think people look at that and they want to try and recreate that, but you can't just start your movie by saying Episode 4. And, you know, writing Raiders of the Lost Ark is really difficult. Well, I've tried.
You know, besides the Episode 4 thing in Star Wars, there aren't, like, winks to the audience of, like, remember movies from 60 years ago?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So I feel like people are looking for other things about the pulps that they can jump on. Like, even Flash Gordon. You know, Flash Gordon has those very distinct set pieces and cliffhangers within the same movie. It's one of the reasons that I think Flash Gordon actually feels like a really weird movie, because there's like 10 cliffhangers in one movie and no break. Like, Flash almost dies 10 times in a bunch of weird and exotic set pieces. Like, they're trying to latch onto something that hadn't been done yet, and sometimes things hadn't been done yet because they're just weird.
The other thing about Star Wars and, well, Star Wars totally, Indiana Jones less so. Certainly Raiders of the Lost Ark pulls it off. Temple of Doom doesn't quite pull it off. But those are movies that sidestep a lot of the questionable imperialistic and racial overtones of movies or serials and pulp stuff of that era, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we got into this a little bit with The Shadow and how The Shadow sort of handled the Yellow Peril stuff reasonably well, but maybe not perfectly. The Phantom is a character who is entirely steeped in, like, Heart of Darkness, White Man's Burden, Dark Continent of Africa stuff.
Yeah, he's one of those, he's a white savior in the jungle. Like, yes. That's his entire deal. And that's kind of been his entire deal until this year, when the Dynamite Comics that Brian Clevenger was writing actually introduced a new Phantom who was black.
Which is very smart.
Yes.
I don't recall how this movie handles it at all. And if I have a major trepidation about going back and watching this, it is in that. Because, yeah. Well, we watched Doc Savage, and boy oh boy, is there a lot of questionable depictions of natives in that movie, right? Oh,
Unga Gunga.
Yeah.
Actually, goddamn say Unga Gunga.
So, yes, this movie, that was in 1970-something. This one's in 1990-something. Maybe it's a little better in this one. But I genuinely have no recollection one way or another how it's handled.
Aside from that, can we talk about the origin of the Phantom in the comics?
Sure.
Created by Lee Falk, who at the time was probably best known as the creator of Mandrake the Magician, another King Features syndicate. the Phantom has one of the best origins in comics. Like, one of the most creative, one of the coolest, one of the most adaptable. I love the Phantom's origin. Like, in theory, I really like the Phantom. In practice, not so much. The deal with the Phantom is that in the 1500s, his ancestor, you know, Christopher Walker, was shipwrecked by pirates. And so he, you know, landed in Africa and then basically became a vigilante hunting down pirates for revenge. Like, he dedicated his life to hunting down pirates. But that role was then passed down from father to son over the course of hundreds of years. So that by the time we see the Phantom who shows up in 1936, the Phantom, he's the 21st Phantom. Like, when we meet him, he's the 21st Phantom. Kit Walker is the heir to this legacy. And it's one of the first times, because you and I have talked about this, about whether the Phantom is a pulp hero or a superhero, and how he kind of straddles the line between them. Because he certainly has the look of a superhero.
Well, we got a question on the War Rocket Ajax Tumblr a while back about what the difference between a pulp hero and a superhero is. And I enumerated four or five different attributes that really differentiate between the two of them. Location is one of them, or their setting. Superheroes are always in an American urban setting, generally. Not always, but a lot of times.
Whereas
pulp heroes travel the world and often get embroiled in that kind of imperialistic storytelling. Costumes are a part of it, but the Phantom is an exception to that. The Phantom is one of the few I can think of that wears, like, spandex. Methods is a big part of it. Pulp heroes are way more inclined to use guns, and superheroes are way more inclined to beat up bad guys with fists. Villains are often quite different, even though there's some overlap there. And I think I had a couple other criteria. As I was writing that out, you know, I kept coming back to the Phantom as the character that sort of most closely straddles the line, at least on the pulp side.
In the same way that the very early, you know, the first couple of years of Batman are the bridge between, you know, pulp vigilante and superhero vigilante, the Phantom is very much kind of a prototype for the same thing, like the non-powered superhero. But the hook of it is that because that role is passed down, everyone from the outside, everyone who isn't reading the story, you know, thinks that the Phantom is just an immortal, like this immortal warrior who has been battling evil for 400 years, when that's not the case. It's, you know, the Phantom gets killed. All, like, 20 people who have been the Phantom have been killed by the time that we meet Kit Walker. So, I mean, that's really cool. That's, like, a really, really great idea, because you can not only, like, there's not only an instant tradition there and an instant, like, way to send this guy on world-traveling adventures, but if you want, you can do a story about the 18th Phantom or the 9th Phantom or, you know, go back to pirate days. And so you get one of the first heroes who gets to have this legacy, and you get to see other versions of him kind of built on the same costume. Like, he doesn't feel like a character from 1936. He feels like a much more modern invention, in the same way that, you know, Plastic Man or The Spirit or Metamorpho feel like more modern comics. Sure. I like the idea of the Phantom a lot.
Yeah, I do too. And I feel like I've liked the idea of the Phantom a lot more than any stories or adaptations of the character in my recollection. You know what I mean? He's kind of like the Riddler in that way, in that I tend to like the character himself more than the stories that he is featured in. Though there have been more good Riddler stories of late than I feel like there have been more good Phantom stories.
Yeah, I mean, the only Phantom stories that I actually really like are King's Watch and the current Phantom series from Dynamite, which, again, are the last 2-3 years.
Yeah. Now, since we're talking about kind of more recent Phantom adaptations, we got an email from a fan named Claudio Serena, who lives in Milan.
Who, oh, interesting. Hi, Claudio. Buongiorno.
Wanted to give us a couple of interesting little tidbits about the Phantom. Recent news, or somewhat recent news. One is that there is a tribe in Papua New Guinea that has started painting the Phantom on their shields to evoke his force and speed.
Yes. And this is awesome. I'm actually going to revive the Movie Fighters Tumblr to post this.
What I love about that is that it is a tribe taking culture that is all about, you know, the white man's burden and making it their own and sort of claiming it. That's like a nice reversal of what all that pulp culture of the 30s and 40s was all about, right?
Yes.
I think that's kind of neat. And then the other thing that Claudio wanted us to know is that there was a miniseries, a TV miniseries, in 2009 and 2010 that tried to revive the Phantom franchise.
Oh, that's right. When we were originally talking about doing the pulp movies back at Comics Alliance a few years ago, I went to go look for the DVD and found that on Amazon, and I had never heard of it.
It is apparently about a new Phantom, the son of a previous Phantom.
Mm-hmm.
And he is like a parkour guy. I'll just
that does sound pretty fun.
I'll read the IMDb plot summary. Law student Chris Moore is an urban daredevil who gets his kicks from racing across rooftops. When a secret organization approaches him with proof that he's actually the son of a legendary international crime fighter called the Phantom, he is thrust into a world he never knew existed, a world of exotic islands, secret lairs, and a heritage that borders on royalty. Reimagined and reloaded, this classic superhero is upgraded for the 21st century with a new state-of-the-art costume and a newly formed rivalry against some of the most techno-savvy villains to ever terrorize the world. It's explosive action and nonstop adventure from start to finish as the Phantom comes to life. Now, that sounds like almost overcompensating. You know,
I like the
techno savvy villains.
Say that it's reimagined and reloaded.
Yeah, techno savvy villains, and he's a parkour guy. It's like just a flashing sign that says "modern, modern, modern." Right.
Right.
I feel like this movie does quite the opposite. It tries to be a throwback, and in some ways, I think that ends up being its downfall.
One more thing. We've talked about the marketing blitz for all these movies and how heavy the marketing was for stuff like Dick Tracy, how heavy the marketing was for The Shadow. The Phantom didn't quite have that same marketing blitz. I mean, there were a lot of ads, you know, the famous Slam Evil ad that was in the comics of the time. But it did coincide with the relaunch of the Phantom on television in a syndicated animated series called Phantom 2040 that was about the Phantom in the year 2040.
I remember this show.
Do you remember it? Do you remember that the comics were drawn by Steve Ditko?
I do not remember that.
Yeah, the co-creator of Spider-Man drew the licensed Phantom 2040 cartoon adaptation comics.
Delightful. Yeah. I remember that cartoon being not very good.
There was a video game. I don't know if I ever watched the cartoon, but I did play the Super Nintendo game. And I also do not think that was very good.
Well, that is unfortunate. All right, before we watch The Phantom from 1996, we are going to figure out what our snack situation is. Chris, what you snacking on over there?
As I have promised, Matt, I am going for it. I'm going traditional this week. I'm going to go, as soon as we pause it, right before we start the movie, I'm going to go make some popcorn. And I'm going to snack on some popcorn and a big movie theater-sized glass of ice water that I have here.
Wonderful. I just came back from a trip to the grocery store, and part of my excursion was to find something to snack on for Movie Fighters. What I found was a bag of Creative Snacks Companies based in Greensboro, North Carolina. Not a sponsor, even though we would take their sponsorship if they offered it to us. Strawberry yogurt pretzels.
Ooh.
Rich, creamy, sweet, and salty, they are called. We may come back and say what we think about those snacks, but we are definitely going to come back and say what we think about The Phantom, starring Billy Zane, right after this musical interlude. We are back from watching The Phantom.
Oof. The Ghost Who Sleeps.
I feel like I need a long nap after that one.
I gotta say, if you watch this movie on Amazon, customers who watch this item also watched The Shadow, Doc Savage, and Dick Tracy. So boy, do they have us pegged.
And Steel.
And Steel.
Yeah.
And then Mario Van Peebles in Solo, which I would much rather watch than this movie. And something I would love to watch, Runaway, the movie where Tom Selleck fights Gene Simmons in the future.
So before we get going on the plot, I want to talk about two really quick things. The cast and director of this movie, which we didn't talk about in the intro at all. The cast of this movie is loaded. We talked about Billy Zane a bit in the intro part and how much we are Zaniacs now. But the rest of the cast also pretty good. Catherine Zeta-Jones is one of the villains. Treat Williams is the lead antagonist. Christy Swanson is Diana Palmer, the female lead. James Remar is one of the bad guys. One of our absolute favorites of all time.
CHT!
Hiroyuki Tagawa is the head of the pirate organization that appears throughout the movie. David Proval, who you may remember from the Sopranos, is one of the henchmen. Patrick McGoohan is in this.
Yes. Patrick McGoohan is in this. This is a movie that has CHT and Patrick McGoohan, and it is still garbage. It is still complete garbage.
A loaded cast, and the director is an interesting fellow. His name is Simon Winsor, and here are the movies he is, according to IMDb, known for. The Phantom, 1996, Free Willy, 1993, Quigley Down Under, 1990, and Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles, 2001.
Is that the one where Crocodile Dundee's back?
And he's in Los Angeles.
Okay, good.
One of his more recent films is NASCAR, The IMAX Experience.
Judging by this movie, that is the most boring IMAX experience that it is possible to have.
The most boring.
I hope it's just a giant picture of a car. There's one more that we didn't talk about, Matt. That is writer Jeffrey Boehm.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Jeffrey Boehm, now we talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark in the intro. Jeffrey Boehm wrote Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
He did.
That movie's great. He also wrote Lethal Weapon 2 and Lethal Weapon 3. And The Lost Boys.
Yep.
So, what happened here?
And this is his last credited script.
Yeah, he died 4 years after this movie came out. His known for on IMDb does not include The Phantom. It includes those other four movies.
I want to say it's not the fault of the screenwriter. It's the fault of the director. But I think we'll get into that more in our high points and low points.
Yeah, but like even just looking at the script, like if you look at Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, it's a period piece. It's a bunch of set pieces. It's a father and son story, which is a very important part of The Phantom. It's very much like, yeah, if you could write that, why couldn't you write The Phantom? Like, I feel like The Phantom is like a first draft Indiana Jones script, which is kind of reinforced by the fact that it's about crystal skulls, or at least skulls, that he just, you know, shaved off Indiana Jones and grafted on The Phantom. Like, that's kind of what it feels like.
Yeah. It is. And, look, I really don't know where this movie went wrong, but we'll try to figure it out once we get through the plot of the movie, which
let's blow through this nothing of a plot we just watched.
It's not a lot of movie stretched out into 100 minutes. Yeah, I don't know. So, okay, the thing that we talked about at the beginning where I said there's the thing that comes up on the screen that says, in case you just came in. That is, I thought that was like further into the movie than it is. It is the first thing that pops up on the screen.
Yeah.
Which means it's got to be some kind of like weird throwback to serialized movie storytelling stuff. But I really don't know. But what you get in that segment is a quick origin of the Phantom, where you discover that the first ever Phantom, his father was killed by the Singh Brotherhood, which is a group of dastardly pirates, mostly Asian pirates, who edge up on the precipice of being racist. I don't know if they quite get there, but they come close.
They're very yellow peril-y. You know, the bloodthirsty, you know, bloodthirsty modern day pirates. To his credit, once Kerry Hiroyuki Tagawa shows up in the last, what,
10 minutes
of the movie?
Yeah.
He does a really good job, you know, of working with his material, which is kind of what Hiroyuki Tagawa's specialty is. Like,
yes.
Do not mistake us for two people who ironically enjoy CHT. Like, we're genuine fans. I love that guy.
He is an actor that elevates material that almost seems beyond being elevated. He's really good at it.
He's consistently really great. I wouldn't say that it gets to the level of a Shuan Khan, even, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah. Okay, so his father is killed by these pirates. He washes up on the shore of an island called Bengala. And the narration...
Yeah, this is the part.
The narration says, "Seems like it should have been out of the frying pan and into the fire. But the natives meant him no harm." And then it continues to explain how the natives took him in and raised him. He was given...
How they carried him on a palanquin to the village and bestowed unto him mystical artifacts.
Yes, namely the ring that the Phantom wears. And out of the ring comes the titles, with a whoosh sound effect. And I swear to God, all the sound effects in this movie are from a 101 Easy Sound Effects CD. Because they are like the most basic, you've heard them a million times sound effects.
Yeah, the sound design in this movie, not great. The score is bad, the sound effects are kind of bad. The score is like frequently weird. Like, it's occasionally very, like, peppy and upbeat while we're watching a child almost die here in this opening sequence.
Okay, so while we're talking about
And then it will be playing, like, very exciting music while nothing is happening, which is most of the movie.
While we're talking about the opening sequence, as soon as the concept of the Phantom is introduced, we don't see the Phantom for maybe 15 minutes. Because instead, we're following a group of bumbling jungle adventurers led by James Remar, who we later find out not only has an attachment to the Singh Brotherhood somehow, he also has an attachment to New York business tycoon Xander Drax, who's played by Treat Williams, who has a big plan for the artifacts that he sent James Remar to go get. So James Remar, another guy, and a little Bengala-ese kid. I don't know what the term is. I want to say Bengalese, but that's obviously wrong.
Bengalian, I think, maybe?
Okay. This Bengalan, kid,
maybe? Who knows?
This kid, who does not speak English, is in the truck with these two guys. I guess he's been kidnapped by them. And he's acting as their guide. And he proves quickly that James Remar is not very bright, because he says that he's got the map upside down, and that's why he's seeing things wrong and things aren't showing up wrong on the, or correctly on the map. They come to a bridge along the road. It is a very classic movie-style rope bridge. Yet, it is sturdy enough that a huge truck in 1938, which has to weigh a couple tons, gets across it quite safely.
Well, he drives very slowly.
The gag here is that all the white guys know that it's going to be extremely dangerous to drive across the bridge. So they all walk across, and they make this little kid drive the truck across the bridge.
Matt, can I just say real quick that I'm already bored?
I halfway enjoyed the gag of them making the kid drive across the bridge, just because it proves that they're total shits. They are complete cowardly assholes.
The actual thing that I wrote down in my notes was some real shit dudes in this opening. And the next line is real shit dudes who get violently murdered.
Yes. So they finally get to the cave that they're trying to go to. They go in the cave. They find the one artifact that they've been sent to find, which is a silver skull with blue jewels for eyeballs. And we find out that this thing is extremely important. It is one of the most important artifacts on the planet Earth. It can bestow somebody with immense power. But it is just sitting in a cave in Bengala, among some other crap. Like, nobody is protecting it. It's not being kept safe in any demonstrable way. It's just sitting there.
I mean, there's some, like, pirate treasure in there. There's, like, gold coins. But it's all, like, dusty, and it is an open cave full of dusty billions of dollars in treasure.
The Phantom lives on the island of Bengala and has a giant stronghold. He probably knows where that skull is. Why doesn't he go get it and put it in his stronghold where it will be safe? That's my question.
So one of the skeletons in this pirate treasure cave comes to life and just strangles a guy. It's kind of shockingly violent for the way this movie opens, with a skeleton strangling a man and then a bunch of people saying shit a whole bunch.
Yeah.
And it's weird because, as you pointed out, Matt, this movie's PG. And this is another weird PG movie about a guy who shoots people with two guns.
Well, The Shadow was PG-13. But this movie has more shooting and more cursing immediately, because
immediately, like, up front,
as soon as the one guy gets strangled by the skeleton, the rest of the goons decide that they're going to take some treasure. They load up the truck and then they just start running out of there, because the Phantom shows up and there's a short conversation about how there's this guy, the Phantom. He's the ghost who walks, or the man who never dies. There's a little bit about the rumors around him, the mythology around him being immortal. But James Remar's like, you ain't got to worry about that guy. I killed him. And that is how we find out that James Remar, who is not a particularly notable character otherwise, is the guy who killed the last Phantom, who was Patrick McGoohan.
Right, you would think that this movie would be about the, like, Billy Zane getting his revenge on the criminal who killed his father, right? The pirate who killed his father. I would say James Remar is number four on the list of villains in this movie. I would put him below Catherine Zeta-Jones even, because she is a much more interesting character. James Remar is just not developed at all. Like, he's just a guy who killed the Phantom one time. And then it is later explained that he, you know, betrayed Patrick McGoohan and literally stabbed him in the back. But again, that's something that's all explained by a ghost, by a for real ghost.
Yeah, and
so,
like, you'd think that the movie would take advantage of, like, showing it in a flashback at least. But no.
Yeah.
It is just talked about, and that is it, which is something this movie does far more often than it ought to.
Yeah, there's a lot of tell don't show in this movie.
So the Phantom comes busting out as these goons are running away with their skull of Tuganda, I should say. And he just comes out guns blazing. Like, the first thing we see him doing is just blasting shots at these guys. He jumps on their truck as they're trying to drive away. He punches James Remar in the face. And we see that James Remar has a scar on his face where the Phantom's ring had, like, hit him on the side of his cheek. The Phantom then also punches the other guy and leaves a scar on his face. But
yeah, but it's like, they don't look like impressions of a ring. They look like burns.
Yeah.
Like the Phantom, like, you know, gets a lighter and puts it on his ring for a little bit while it's on his hand, and then immediately punches you in the face. Like, that's what it looks like.
Somehow in their fight, which they're fighting as James Remar is driving, and somehow James Remar is not running into stuff despite him driving through the middle of a jungle.
Like, through a literal jungle.
You would think he might hit a tree, but no. He manages to get the truck all the way to the bridge, and he ends up ditching the truck right before driving it onto the bridge, leaving the Phantom on there. The Phantom has to go back and save that kid, whose name, weirdly enough, is Zach. This kid from a remote island, whose name is Zach. It's fine. He saves the kid, and what follows is the first of, like, several very tedious action sequences. Like, I feel like this is supposed to be suspenseful. Like, we're supposed to be like, how's the Phantom and Zach gonna get out of this? But instead, it's just super tedious watching him, like, climb out of this truck as the bridge is breaking, shoot a vine, and then swing to safety. It lasts so much longer than it should.
And the thing is, like, it's, you know, you've seen it before. Like, it is a thing we have all seen before.
In the suspense of the Phantom having to get out of this perilous situation, James Remar takes the skull and gets out of there and escapes. And takes the skull back to the United States, where we see a big party at a mansion taking place. We see Christy Swanson showing up after having been gone on a long trip. Christy Swanson's character is Diana Palmer. Her uncle, Dave, is the owner of the newspaper The Tribune. Now, Diana is returning from some trip, and I'm not really sure what the trip is, but she shows up wearing, like, Amelia Earhart clothes. Like, she is in full 1930s adventure lady outfit with, like, a beret and everything. At the party that she shows up at, we see I think it's supposed to be tense, but instead it's just very exposition-heavy, standoff between her uncle and Xander Drax, who is this big businessman that the Tribune is doing an investigation of. So Dave Palmer is just telling Drax, you're a bad person who uses pirates to come to your own ends. You're very dishonest and you have ties to the mob. And Xander Drax's response to that is just go, I've never heard such nonsense. And that's pretty much the end of that. So Drax goes off on his own, and Palmer pulls in Diana, the mayor, and the police commissioner into his office because they're going to try to investigate more of what Drax is up to. And they end up settling on the notion of sending Diana to Bengala to find out what exactly Drax is up to, because they know that Drax has been sending agents to Bengala. Then we see the mayor get in Drax's limo and tell him what just happened in the meeting.
This is our introduction to Drax, and even though it's not the best introduction, we should probably talk a little bit about Treat Williams here. Because he's actually really fun, and he's actually really charming to be this movie's villain. Like, to be a guy who essentially wants to get the power to blow up the world, he is extremely charming. Like, he's funny. Like, Treat Williams himself is really affable. I wrote down that he's the Judge Rico to Kurt Russell's Judge Dredd. but Kurt Russell in Furious 7. Like, that kind of, like, weird, charming guy. And again, he has no connection to the Phantom. Like, we get these villains. We get a secondary villain, Kiri Hiroyuki Tagawa, who has a personal connection with the Phantom. We get a tertiary villain, James Remar, who also has a personal connection to the Phantom. Or, you know, maybe flip those around, secondary and tertiary. I just like Kiri Hiroyuki Tagawa more and enjoyed him in this movie more.
He's a Kiri Hiroyuki Tagawa, though he's not in the movie as much, is a more important villain than James Remar is.
A more important villain, and I would say, like, even from what we see of him, a better developed character. Like, James Remar is just, like, a shit dude who killed Billy Zane's dad. Like, those two characters have a personal connection to the Phantom. Xander Drax, which is a hilarious name, and there's actually a really fun bit later on when he introduces himself to Kiri Hiroyuki Tagawa, and he says, Xander Drax, and CHG goes, what? And he goes, Xander Drax, it starts and ends with X. Which is pretty great. But again, like, that's the kind of thing he does. Like, he's really, like, he's charming and affable and seems like he would be a better villain for the Shadow. You know, like, this member of New York High Society, like, who's running things on the side. Like, it just doesn't, like, he has no connection and he's the main villain, which I think is a pretty big flaw in this movie because they give us other villains who do.
Somewhere in here, we find out that Drax's plan is that he's going to collect these three skulls. One is silver. That's the one that he had James Remar go steal. One is emerald. And the other
jade.
One is...
It's jade.
Jade, okay. And then the other one is gold. And he knows where the second one is. I guess we'll just knock out a couple of quick scenes of his really quickly. One, there's a scene where he is in his office, and he's got this scientist kind of character there.
He's a librarian.
Is he, though? Because he asks him to look through a microscope.
Yeah, well, he's a librarian because, like, there's a thrilling conversation about whether or not this librarian guy is telling anyone else what Xander Drax has been looking up in the library. That's a conversation that we have in this movie, that there's like 4 minutes of screen time devoted to whether or not the librarian is telling anyone what the bad guy is reading about in the library. And that scene ends with him getting stabbed in the eyes.
Right, because he has the scientist/librarian guy look in a microscope. And the librarian guy's like, I don't see anything in there. And Drax goes, oh, we'll turn the focus knob.
And, you know, like how you would use a microscope.
And he turns the focus knob, and we see that, I guess we're looking from the librarian's perspective, because into focus comes like this scrawled down note that says liar on it. And then his eyes get stabbed out.
Which it's visible in the microscope, which means it is written microscopically. It is a tiny, tiny little note that he wrote so that this guy would know why he was being stabbed in the eyes.
Which is kind of what's likable about Xander Drax, right? Like, he won't just shoot and kill this guy or, like, stab him in the eyes. He'll make him look at a message that says liar. Like, he's got to do everything a little melodramatically.
Well, the best part of this scene, not just the if you thought the melodrama of making him look in the microscope to read a tiny message and then get stabbed in the eyes was great, the very next thing that happens is that Drax goes, won't be needing this anymore, and snaps the dude's glasses in half.
Yes.
Like, again, he is a charmingly ridiculous supervillain.
there's another scene where Drax is in a boardroom, in his boardroom, and he's explaining to his mobster associates what they're going to do with the three skulls. And there's this one associate who keeps saying that he only has one of them, and he needs all three to do any, like, basically take over the world. And there's just this great moment where Treat Williams turns around and he goes, I know where the second one is! And he's also showing them this plan of his in the form of, like, a PowerPoint presentation. In a 1930s PowerPoint presentation. Yeah, it slides on a projector. That scene's pretty great as well. So, Diana...
And he goes, like, when he's talking to the guy, when the guy's like, you only got one of them, he goes, Raymond? Ray? 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 I know where the other one is. Like, that is how he says it. He's kind of great.
Yeah. So Diana goes and gets on a Pan Am plane. And every plane in this movie is an amphibious plane. Because I guess that's how planes were in this time period.
I mean, I guess if you got to land at those islands.
Anyway, she
Look,
gets
what
on
I know about 1930s aviation is literally all from movies written by the guy who wrote this movie, so...
I know about some stuff from Tailspin, but I don't know what actual time period Tailspin's supposed to be set in.
Tailspin is historically accurate.
Yep. So she gets on the plane. We see her stand in line to get on the plane. Then we see her sitting on the plane for a while. It's like we get like a long travelogue of her plane ride. Finally, some attack planes go and attack her jetliner.
Oh, do we get to see that? Do we get to see like the air pirates like battling against this passenger plane and forcing it down?
No.
Oh.
We cut from the plane starting their attack to Billy Zane in the Phantom Cave getting healed by his assistant and talking to his ghost dad for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Then we cut back and the Sky Pirates have already shot down this Pan Am plane and are boarding it to kidnap Diana.
Right.
Now, we should talk about these Sky Pirates because the concept of them is super cool. It is an all-female group of badass Sky Pirates that can shoot down a plane and kidnap somebody off of it. They never live up to their potential.
Yeah, we only see them in this one scene, and then like one scene later where the Phantom walks in on a bunch of them changing. And the only one who really sticks around is Catherine Zeta-Jones, who, to her credit, is like really fun and enjoyable in this movie. Like, the bad guys, with the exception of James Remar, are like really kind of fun and charming in this. They did a good job with the bad guys.
Catherine Zeta-Jones is their leader. And then there's a whole bunch more of them that just, yeah, they show up and then they disappear. They are in here to do this one thing and then they are gone. Because they take Diana onto a ship and we see James Remar and Catherine Zeta-Jones interrogating Diana to find out why they're what she knows about Drax. And maybe thinking about whether to kill her or not?
Yeah, and I don't really know why. Like, I don't really know why they don't just kill her. Because she's on her way to investigate Drax. And then they kidnap her and ask her what she knows about Drax. Which is nothing yet. Like, she knows her dad is, like, trying to publish that he's mobbed up, but they know that already. That's what they talk about at the party. I don't really... It's a rough patch. It's a rough bit of storytelling.
There is a pretty fun scene, and it is the scene that I said makes this movie pass the Bechdel test, but kind of only...
On a technicality.
There's a scene where Diana and Catherine Zeta-Jones have a conversation about where Diana bought her boots. And then, as a nice little tidbit later in the movie, It seems as though Catherine Zeta-Jones is wearing the same boots that Diana was wearing earlier.
Yeah. My question was, does it still pass the Bechdel test if the women are just talking about shoes? But it does. Nothing in the rules says it doesn't.
So the Phantom is informed by the captain of the Jungle Patrol, who we see in an earlier scene sort of downplaying to one of his colleagues that the Phantom is even real.
Right.
But then we see that he is in cahoots with the Phantom later.
Cahoots.
And he tells the Phantom that Diana's been kidnapped and he should go save her. Because it is maybe not stated until later that Kit Walker and Diana went to college together. So they know each other.
He was educated in America and then returned to... He still knew it being the Phantom. And that's one of the things that I like about this movie. That he's I think according to the timeline of this movie, Patrick McGoohan dies in 36. And he's the Phantom in 1938. And we see him kind of enjoying being the Phantom, which is something that's really nice. Because you don't see that a lot in superhero movies, even today. That he's really, you know, he's new to it all. Everything's really cool. There's a part during the rescue where Devil, who's his pet wolf, shows up and attacks James Remar, and Christy Swanson just goes, "Your dog's a wolf." And he goes, "I know."
Like, yeah.
Is that great?
His delivery on that line specifically is wonderful.
Yeah. He seems to have a lot of fun being the Phantom, which I think plays into him being, you know, he seems like a guy who's new to this whole world of adventure, and that makes it seem fun for him and fun for us, or it would if this movie was any better at portraying itself. But
so he ends up saving Diana with relatively little difficulty. He basically just goes and grabs her, and then they jump on a biplane, one of the pirates' red biplanes.
Yeah, and there's a part flies where Catherine Zeta-Jones has a gun on him. And he's, like, not even looking at her, and he just kind of reaches behind him and takes her gun away really fast. And again, even Catherine Zeta-Jones is like, "Hey, that was pretty cool."
Well, he says, there's an old jungle saying, "Don't point a gun at somebody, it might go off." Which is part of the running gag of this movie about everything being an old jungle saying. Which I think probably the screenwriter thought was funnier than it actually was. Or the director didn't play it up nearly enough.
Yeah, agreed.
Because it's in the script a whole bunch of times. There's a whole bunch of times where they say, "This is an old jungle saying." But it's like they don't hit it hard enough or something.
Yeah, they definitely don't. I didn't even remember that was a running gag until you said it.
It's definitely a runner, but you have to be looking for it to really get it. The Phantom and Diana are on this plane. He leaves his wolf, Devil, on the ship where it could conceivably just be shot and killed.
Yeah, there are a bunch of dudes with guns on that ship. Bunch of dudes with guns.
But Wolf is fine, or the Wolf is fine. Devil is fine.
Yeah, in fact, Devil leaves the ship and goes and talks to a horse.
There is a great moment where a wolf talks to a horse. They, like, nod at each other and then start running through the jungle together. It is amazing. Meanwhile, the Phantom and Diana are on this plane, and it has been shot to pieces. Like, as they were flying away, the pirates kept shooting at them and hit the fuel tank. So it's leaking fuel. They're about to run out of fuel. Luckily, a horse can run as fast as a plane can fly.
Yes.
So
well,
the Phantom...
Only if there's a wolf telling it where it needs to be.
So the Phantom flies the biplane close to the ground. He and Diana jump down onto the horse, and then the plane flies into the side of a mountain. That's one of the better action sequences in the movie, though.
One of the better. It's still not great.
They go back to the Phantom, the Skull Cave is what it's actually called. The Phantom's hideout. The head of the Jungle Patrol is still there. And they get into a conversation with Diana about what she is getting into, she and her uncle. And she shows them this piece of paper that has the image, the logo, I guess you would call it, of the Singh Brotherhood on it. And the Phantom's like, "Oh, you don't know what kind of shit you're getting into." like, does he go to New York immediately after that?
Yeah, he goes to New York because he essentially follows Christy Swanson home because she has mentioned investigating this whole thing with Drax and the skulls. And they get home, and there's a thing where they find out that the skull, like the second skull, the Jade Skull, is at a museum because of Christy Swanson's rich twit maybe boyfriend, who is actually kind of nice. Like, I joked that he's playing Billy Zane in Titanic. Except for he's not, like, a monster.
There are actually several different iterations of Billy Zane characters in this movie. Like, there's the character that Billy Zane himself is playing. There's the rich twit boyfriend. And then there's the villain character that Treat Williams is playing, who seems very much like a character Billy Zane would play.
Yeah, if this movie was Billy Zane versus Billy Zane, and again, I say this as someone who probably enjoyed Treat Williams in this movie more than anyone else, if that role had been played by Billy Zane, this movie would be hilarious.
I feel like Treat Williams is playing the Billy Zane character from, was it Blood Rain that we saw Billy Zane in?
Where he was, man, like, was Billy Zane in Blood Rain?
A ridiculous villain.
I can't
remember. Anyway, Kit arrives in New York as himself, not as the Phantom. And there's a scene where he is getting out of a cab, and the cab driver tells him how much the fare is. He gives the cab driver a wad of money, but it's Bengala money. It's not American money. Even though, from what I can tell, Bengala doesn't have any towns.
Yeah, all the Bengala natives that we see live in trees and are referred to as the rope people because they use ropes.
Yeah. There's nowhere in the country of Bengala that I can recall seeing in this movie where you could spend that currency.
I mean, we see the British jungle police. So presumably Bengala is a colony, I guess.
Well, then wouldn't the money just be British pounds?
So, excellent question, Matt. Again, the most things I know about colonial Africa are from in movies by the screenwriter.
Anyway, the cab driver's like, you can't pay me with this. So Billy Zane just pulls out a pocket full of very valuable gems and gives them all to the cab driver. And so for the rest of the movie, this cab driver is loyal to Billy Zane, is loyal to Kit Williams.
Walker.
I knew I was going to make that mistake.
Not Cat Williams, Kit Walker.
Play in.
The Phantom never discusses how he may or may not be a pimp.
He goes and finds Diana. They all find out that this skull is in the Natural History Museum. So Kit and Diana go to the Natural History Museum, and they find the skull in a display that Kit explains is all wrong. It's like a European display. It looks like it's maybe from, like, supposed to be from, like, the 16th century. It's got, like, all these, like, people in royal garb. And Kit's just sitting there going, wrong continent, wrong century, wrong decor. Everything, they've done everything wrong with this.
Yeah.
And Diana goes, well, okay, how are you going to get the skull? And this is maybe my favorite moment in the entire movie. Kit just picks up a pole, like one of the poles that the velvet rope is on, and just tosses it through the glass.
Yeah, which, you know what? That's a gag that's in Last Crusade.
Yes, it is.
Because Indy picks up the same kind of stand, you know, it's a velvet rope stand, and bashes the floor in to get down into the catacombs in Paris.
Where the big X is in the floor.
Like, I wonder if there's like a, you know how there's a director trademark section on IMDb? Like, I wonder if there's a screenwriter trademark.
Velvet rope pulls going through things.
Yeah.
Now, Drax has set it up so that he was just going to walk in there to the museum and steal that skull too. Because he told the police commissioner, who was in his pocket, hey, keep your men away from the museum.
No actual guards at this museum either.
No. He's like, just keep your men away from the museum. I'm just going to go get the skull. I'm doing it in the middle of the day. No problem. But Kit has already gotten the skull for him, so he just shows up, he and his men pull out a bunch of guns, and they grab the skull out of Kit's hand. And he puts the skull in a bag with the other skull, and then the bag starts smoking. This is because when you put the two skulls together, they pinpoint where the third one is. Now, this is a weird sequence where it just so happens that they happen to be in a room full of artifacts and a map. And the skulls actually start shooting a beam out of their eyes onto the map to show where to go. This is after 15 panes of stained glass break.
Well, the same three panes five times.
Yeah. It is just so much stained glass breaking. They really could have cut that down. I think that's why, like, this movie could have easily been 90 minutes. It probably could have been 80.
You are not incorrect.
Now, here's what's weird. The skulls pinpointed their location on the map. But then Drax goes back to his building, the building that he owns in New York City, and has his people figure out, like, coordinate the coordinates of where they have to go.
What does he call it? He calls it something.
Where they're going? Vortex? He's like,
I've got to check on these this location coordinate thing. And it's like, yeah, it's called a map.
Oh, that's right.
Like, the object you are holding is called a map.
He calls it a location chart.
The best thing that Drax does in that scene is when his men show up and pull guns out on Kit Walker, who was just bashed in the glass on a door in the museum. Drax just turns around to the crowd who's at the museum and goes, "Don't worry, everybody. Everything's under control. There's cold drinks and sandwiches in the nature hall right over there." And everybody just leaves and go has cold drinks and sandwiches.
Yeah, that is the first time I've ever seen a supervillain use the free food ploy, which works beautifully. That's the perfect thing, especially if you're like a tycoon villain, right? If you're a villain who is super rich, just be like, "Hey, there's free food back there." Maybe the only other time I've seen something similar to that is when the Joker started giving everybody free money in Batman 89.
That is kind of the moment where Drax becomes a really charming villain.
As Drax is trying to figure out where to go on the map, and they finally pinpoint that it's an area called the Devil's Vortex.
You know, which is something someone would call something.
But what's weird is they don't just say it's the Bermuda Triangle. Right?
Yeah, or the Devil's Triangle. Like, it's the Devil's Vortex. That just sounds like a roller coaster.
Yeah, I guess they don't want to make it a real location. But it's weird. Yes. Like, there's already locations on the planet Earth that have a reputation for where ships get lost. So I don't know why they have to make it something different. Anyway, there's a scene where some of Drax's henchmen are chasing Kit up a flight of stairs because they're trying to get Kit and Diana to kidnap them. But Kit runs away. Kit ends up trapping them in a room, and then he quick changes into the Phantom and takes care of them and gets away.
Yeah, and there's a very tepid fight scene, and there's like a very tepid escape here too, because he almost gets crushed by an elevator and then rolls out in the lobby right at the nick of time. And look, that is something I recently had nightmares about. And I'm watching this literally thinking, I need to pay my cable bill. Like, it's on the scale of what, like, we have seen in this movie and on the scale of what we should be seeing in this movie, that is nothing. Like, it's very lukewarm.
I have a theory about why so much of that stuff doesn't work, but we'll save it for low points.
Okay.
Diana is still being held by Drax, and Drax and Sala, who is Catherine Zeta-Jones, decide to take Diana with them to the Devil's Vortex as, quote, phantom insurance.
Yeah, I guess.
Because they think that she's the Phantom's girlfriend.
Right, which she is. They're which correct in that.
She already has a boyfriend in New York, who is totally forgotten about, by the way.
Oh, yeah, completely. He is just there to tell them, like, oh, yeah, I've seen a skull like that. It's at the museum.
He's one of several characters who is just there for exposition and then disappears.
Yeah, Diane's dad, her boyfriend, the Phantom's weird manservant.
The head of the Jungle Patrol.
The head of the Jungle Patrol. Like, and there's a lot of bit parts in here who do nothing but say one piece of information and then leave. The Phantom's dad. The ghost of the Phantom's dad is yeah. like that.
He shows up a few times, but pretty much. They fly on planes to the island. They find
with the Phantom riding outside the plane.
Yeah, he gets on one of the pontoons of the plane and just sits there for the entire plane ride, which had to be hours long.
Yeah, it's from New York City to wherever the Devil's Vortex is, which we can assume is tropical.
Somewhat
because
remote.
There are pirate ships involved.
Yes. When they get to the island that is inside the Devil's Vortex.
There's actually Chinese pirates involved, which would mean like 6 or 7,000 miles of flying.
They get to the island, and what they find is the hideout of the Singh Brotherhood, which is headed up by Kabai Singh, who is finally, we get Kirihiroyuki Tagawa.
CHT in the house. And I will say, this is kind of like the escape from the boat was when I was like, wow, this movie was really interesting for 10 minutes because it's kind of a fun, interesting action sequence. The set piece of this pirate base is really cool because it's this underground, like through the caves pirate base where everything is built around like hulks of old ships. Like Kirihiroyuki Tagawa's throne is on a pirate ship. That's just kind of, you know, stuck in this place where all these ships have been wrecked and been torpedoed. Like, it's a really cool set piece. It does not really pay off in any way, but it's a cool looking set.
Yeah, it reminded me, weirdly enough, of a lot of like the pirate slash Viking hideouts in Skyrim.
Yeah, yeah.
That you have to like.
We made a lot of Assassin's Creed comparisons in this movie.
What's weird in this sequence is that there's a long conversation between Drax and the head of the Singh Brotherhood where they're trying to like make a deal because Kabai Singh has the last skull in his possession, the gold one. Drax is trying to cut a deal with him so that he can get all three skulls and they can kind of have this power together.
Oh, but what about the fourth skull?
Singh brings up that there's a fourth skull, you idiot. And without that, you can't do anything. And Drax's reaction to that is actually really funny because he's like, no, there's not. There is not a fourth skull. Is it just like incredulous? Like he just can't believe the notion that there's a fourth skull. But this is weird because like this is a big standoff that the Phantom is just not involved in at all.
Yeah, the Phantom's right? Like there. And also, there's a part, like, right before this where Christy Swanson talks to Catherine Zeta-Jones, who is the leader of a gang of air pirates. And Christy Swanson just goes, why are you like this? Like, why are you so mean? And that's kind of a turning point for Catherine Zeta-Jones' character because then, like, when they get to this pirate base and they're all kind of taken prisoner by Kirihiroyuki Tagawa, she's like, hey, we should probably stick together. And then they become friends.
Yes.
Like, they have punched each other in the face.
They're just, like, instant friends. You know, girlfriends gotta stick together. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
There's a part in here where the head of the Singh Brotherhood shoots a guy with a cannon.
That shit is hilarious.
Because, well, what's great about it is that he gets shot with a cannon. Nobody else is affected by this cannon blast. And the cannonball doesn't go through the guy. It launches him like 40 feet back into the water.
Yeah. He shot at point blank range with a cannon.
It's so cartoonish. It's hilarious. The Phantom doesn't actually get involved in any of this until Diana is put in danger. The topic of the Phantom is brought up to Kabai Singh, And Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa's kind of like, oh, you better not mess with the Phantom. Like, that guy is immortal and is the ghost who walks, and you should not mess with him. And then they're like, oh, well, she's his girlfriend. And Kobayashi Singh's like, really? So he kind of grabs Christy Swanson and is like being a little rough with her. And that is when the Phantom shows up and just starts shooting the shit out of pirates. Like, he's he's crossing his arms and then uncrossing them and then crossing them back, standing on top of this throne area, shooting pirates. We should also note here that the pirates, the Singh Brotherhood, at least this iteration of them, not entirely Asian. They're like a diverse crowd of pirates.
Yeah, I mean, James Remar is one of them.
Yeah. So, like, at least at this point, they are not entirely Yellow Peril stereotypes. Like, Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa is their leader, but there are members of other races there. So they are not totally an Asian group, which is kind of refreshing in its way, I guess.
Yeah.
So in the midst of all of this, there's just a huge fight that breaks out. And Drax manages to get his hands on that third skull. All three of the skulls combine, and then suddenly Drax has this thing that is shooting a green laser beam out of it. As the Phantom is finally having his final showdown with James Remar. And like saying, like, hey, you killed my dad.
Matt, I might have spaced out for a second. Did we talk about how Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa dies?
We have not talked about that.
Yeah, so CHT is having a sword fight with the Phantom. And he's like, yeah, hey, guess what? I know you're not immortal. I know your secret. I know that you are just fathers and sons passing the identity down. I'm going to kill you now. And the Phantom's like, whatevs. And CHT goes to stab him, overcommits, and does a front flip into piranha-infested waters. And it is... it's less believable than the fight scene on the Penguin sub at the end of Batman 66. But it's the exact kind of motion.
It's
the same kind of motion.
It is some bad, bad fight choreography.
Yeah, and the other pirates, speaking of, are trapped by a fishing net that comes down from the ceiling, which is another very Batman 66 kind of moment.
That Catherine Zeta-Jones, who is now fully a good guy, has cut down upon them. The Phantom finally is facing down James Remar and is going to get his revenge for James Remar killing his dad. But before the Phantom can even do that, this green laser beam accidentally hits James Remar and vaporizes him.
Yeah, this green laser beam that's been, like, cutting through metal and, like, burning holes in rock and shit, for some reason kills James Remar and then stops. Like, it doesn't go through him and also kill Billy Zane.
Yeah, it's like it's got a recharge.
Yeah. Oh, but only after it kills a person, not when it's cutting through metal.
But it's really just plot convenient so that the Phantom can talk for a minute about how the fourth skull is his ring. And then he and Xander Drax can have a literal beam fight with each other, where, like, one beam is shooting into the other, and they're kind of, like, going back and forth like a tug of war for a while. And let me tell you, those are some not good special effects that are happening.
It's real bad.
However, it is almost totally saved by Treat Williams when he is beaten, like, when the Phantom's beam beats out the other three skulls' beam. The beam gets to him, like, the skulls start exploding. He incinerates, and just as he's about to incinerate, what he says is just, unbelievable! Because he loves the spectacle of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much it. You got it.
It seems like Xander Drax just wants life to be a big circus. Like, he just wants to be entertained all the time. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So meanwhile, Diana and Catherine Zeta-Jones have gone and gotten on a submarine that these 1938 pirates just happen to have. Somehow they got that technology that I think only Germany had at that time.
I think you're correct. I guess had U-boats been used in World War I during the blockade? I think so.
Maybe.
So they've been around for 20 years then, I guess.
It's plausible, I suppose, that these pirates could have them.
Yeah, but it looks to be about like 70 years old. It's rusted and like it looks like what you would envision a World War II submarine to look like now.
The Phantom regroups with them after Xander and the pirates are all beaten. They go back to Bengala. Christy Swanson, who apparently did not go to wardrobe that day, because she is straight up wearing some 1996 clothes in this last scene. She hangs out in the Phantom's headquarters for a little while. She and Billy Zane have like an awkward conversation about how they might really be into each other, but she's got to get back to New York, and he's got to carry on the tradition of the Phantom because he's really the 21st Phantom. And he shows her like the memorial to her dad, who was number 20.
His dad.
His dad, sorry. They go back to the beach. Catherine Zeta-Jones is waiting on a plane for her new bestie, Diana, so they can fly back to New York. By the way,
the shot of them flying back to New York is actually kind of like, it looks like a romance.
Yeah, they certainly have a platonic love between them.
Like, Catherine Zeta-Jones waves at Christy Swanson when she comes out of the skull cave. Like the Phantom is going like, hey, go back to your wife. I'll see you later. I walk a lonely road.
Christy Swanson is like, hey, bro, before I leave, I'm going to need to see that face of yours. And Billy Zane's like, I don't think I can do that. I don't think I can give you all my secrets. And she goes, why not? Come on, show me that face. So he takes off his mask, and suddenly his eye makeup disappears.
Yeah, which is hilarious.
And he's just good old Billy Zane. And he tells her that the only person that he can show his face to, like unmask as the Phantom in front of, is the woman that will be his wife. And she goes, well, what if I refuse? And Billy Zane kind of just like non-answers it. Like he just kind of doesn't let that go. Even though
he just goes, nobody says no to the Phantom.
Yeah, that's what he says. But like, my take on it is that it's totally a legally binding agreement. Like, they are now married. Like, there is no getting out of that agreement.
Bengala law, man. Gotta watch out for it.
Diana reassures the audience that she will return to the Phantom's jungle and to Kit one day. That is how Wikipedia says the movie ends.
Oh, boy.
And then we get credits of a lot of very loving shots of Australian beaches and jungles. All right, Chris, what are our high points of 1996's The Phantom?
Wake up, everybody. Wake up. It's Chris and Matt time again. We're through the summary. Wake up. High points. The cast is actually really solid.
Yeah,
Billy Zane is really kind of fun and enjoyable. Tree Williams is again, really fun. He probably has the best material to work with, too. Christy Swanson's not bad, and Catherine Zeta-Jones is, like, you know, a really, like, fun kind of femme fatale.
Yeah.
Up to the point where she stops, like, it just immediately goes, hey, sorry, let's be besties. Let's be pals. Yeah.
Nobody is outright bad. Like, we talked about how much kind of a non-character James Remar is, but that's more the script's fault than his.
Yeah.
Like, James Remar is actually never really that bad in anything. And
no, he just, like, doesn't have much to do here.
Yeah.
Like, and he, like, the worst you can say about Remar is that he doesn't make the most of what he has, which is what CHT and Tree Williams are doing.
Yeah. He kind of just plays up to the material.
Right.
But
right.
I don't know that that's a knock on him.
Yeah. I mean, like, he doesn't have many options. He probably didn't go in wanting to, like, because look, CHT chews scenery.
Oh yeah,
he is a scenery hog, which is great for him, and it works in this movie too. But like, you know, I don't think James Remar went in wanting to do that.
Even though conceivably his character should be more important than many other characters, because he killed the Phantom's dad.
Yes.
But there is no one actor in this movie that I think is out and out bad. Like, Patrick McGowan's pretty good, even though I don't know what's going on with his accent in this.
It's, well, again, I mean, he's Patrick McGowan. This movie's a waste of Patrick McGowan.
Sure, but he does fine with the material he gets. Like, he's enjoyable. He's like good old cantankerous Patrick McGowan.
Yeah. But, you know, he's not even Braveheart Patrick McGowan in this. And he's certainly not the prisoner Patrick McGowan. I think you can blame a lot of that on the material.
I also think, and we were talking about this as we were watching the movie, I think the costumes in this are really good. We talked about how much I did not like the civilian clothes in the shadow,
mm-hmm.
particularly what Alec Baldwin wears. I like everything that everybody wears in this movie. The costumes are A+. Not to mention, the New York scenes present a way more believable, way more realistic, way more sort of engrossing 1930s New York than The Shadow does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really has the feel of the period and doesn't feel like, you know, a fake movie set.
Yeah. In those scenes, you're right. The Phantom, I think, like, the costume is weird because, again, it's weirdly ornate, but it's kind of subtly ornate. Like I said, it's basically like purple, but with a slightly darker purple forming patterns on it. They take out his trunks, so he doesn't have his trunks, so that, you know, we can mark that as starting, well, I guess we can mark that as starting in 1989, because Batman didn't have him either.
Right.
But he does look like the Phantom. You know, he does, he's got a weird skull cap and a domino mask and a big old gun belt with a big Phantom logo on it. He does look like the Phantom. He just looks like the movie version of the Phantom.
The headpiece is a little weird because it's a different material than the rest of the costume, and that's really noticeable. But other than that, you know, I think it looks great.
It had to be mega uncomfortable.
Oh, sure.
Because they were filming this in Australia and Thailand, and it, like, that stuff does not look like it breathes.
Well, while we're talking
Billy Zane looks great, by the way.
Well, while we're talking about Billy Zane, like, we talked about the cast. Billy Zane is easily, of the four pulp movies we watched, easily the most charming, affable, enjoyable lead character of any of the movies.
Yeah, he has personality that comes through. Where many of the other movies we watched did not at all.
And it's all personality that strictly comes out of his performance. There's nothing in the script that really gives him any particular personality. It's the way he plays it.
Like the line about the, you know, hey, your dog's a wolf. There's a lot of different ways you can play that. I know. But he gives it that kind of exuberance and that, like, yeah, this is awesome. Yeah, I'm a superhero. It's great. That makes that set piece really work, and then a lot of, you know, I feel like the last set piece is pretty decent, but those would be my high points.
One, as we're talking about Billy Zane, I want to read two items of trivia from IMDb about him and this movie, which makes me like him all that much more. Billy Zane worked out for over a year to fill the Phantom's costume. A Batman-like costume with fake muscles was reportedly made, but by the time filming started, Zane was so muscular that he did not need it.
Yeah, and like one of the early scenes of this movie is him sitting around without a shirt on, and you can tell.
Yeah. And then the other item here is that when not filming, Billy Zane had a habit of running down to buy sushi in a store wearing his Phantom costume.
That's pretty great. That's pretty great.
All right, what are our main low points for The Phantom?
There's a lot of them. But the main all-encompassing problem with this movie for me was that there are four other movies in this movie that I would rather be watching. I would rather be watching The Phantom track down his father's killer. I would rather be watching The Phantom dealing with his archenemies in the Sang Brotherhood. I would rather be watching world-traveling adventurer Christy Swanson fighting against Air Pirate Queen Catherine Zeta-Jones and having to, you know, team up and eventually form a friendship as they deal with a more dangerous threat. I'd rather see the Phantom fighting an all-female army of air pirates. Like, there are ideas in this movie that are way more interesting than the idea that we're watching.
Yeah. I agree.
Like they picked the worst part of this movie to direct our attention to.
I think we've talked about the script and whether that's the problem. I don't know that entirely is. I think if the action sequences in this movie had been exciting instead of tedious, we would like this movie. But every action sequence is so tedious. And that is either the director is entirely to blame for it, or it's the director and the editor. And as we were watching, I was saying that it seemed like this movie was edited very quickly. There's one really bad cut that I noticed as the Phantom and Diana are being chased by the pirates on Bengala. I feel like the editing in particular is just really noticeably bad. Like, when, for instance, when the Phantom is about to get crushed by that elevator, when he's in the elevator shaft, the part where the elevator is coming down on him and he jumps out just in time, it feels like it's happening in slow motion. It's like it's not, nothing's happening in real time. And maybe that's actually more close to like the amount of time that would really take. Mm-hmm. But we're so used to movie editing being so like bang, 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 that kind of stuff should be happening so much faster. And it just feels slow and tedious, and you're like, let's get this over with. We know he's not going to be crushed by the elevator. Just get him out of there.
Yeah, it's – I kind of want to put the blame on the stunts because nothing in this movie is exciting. Like, that opening sequence with the bridge, even though we've seen it time and time again, like, that is a classic cliche of pulp action. When the Phantom swings to safety, it could not look more like he's swinging in front of a matte painting or a green screen, but also it's just like kind of awkward. But I don't know how much of that is the stunts and the stunt coordinator and the stuntmen, who I'm sure, you know, again, are risking their lives for our enjoyment. I don't know how much of it is them not quite being up to par. And again, how much of it is the editing and direction. Because there are things that happen in this movie that should be exciting.
Right.
Like the Phantom jumps off a plane onto a horse. That should be exciting. It is not.
I think special effects may be to blame as well, because some of the parts where the shots are clearly special effects are dismal. The part where all three skulls combine and are kind of flying around in midair looks awful. The part where the island in the Devil's Vortex is exploding is the fakest looking shit that you could have in a movie. It looks like a Windows screensaver from Windows 95. It's really unappealing. And, you know, the budget of this movie was like $45 million. And you cannot see it on the screen, at least not in the special effects.
There was a part where I said, man, this Phantom fan film is really long and boring.
Well, yeah, like things that should be exciting sequences just don't happen. Like, we don't see the part where the Sky Pirates shoot down the jetliner. Why? Why don't we see that?
Yeah, the climactic battle with the leader of the Sang Brotherhood ends when the Phantom jumps out of the way real quick and he does a front flip into the water. Like, it's like the scriptwriter wrote, you know, scene 14, the air pirates, the air pirates led by Sala show up and force the passenger jet to land. And instead of, like, giving that to a stunt coordinator and an action director and the effects people, they were just like, okay, so we're going to show the planes showing up, and then we'll cut to the next piece of dialogue. Like they did exactly what was in the script without expanding any of the action.
Which, again, makes me think it's not the screenwriter's fault. It makes me think that it's the filmmaker's fault.
Jeffrey Boehm has a pretty solid track record. Like, Lethal Weapon 2 and 3 are really fun action movies. And there's a lot of really exciting stuff in them. Last Crusade is, I don't know if I like it better than Raiders, but I like it as much as I like Raiders, and there's a hell of a lot of good action in that. I don't know if this is, like, you know, it was his last one, so he had kind of run out of steam, or if he was just, you know, doing it real quick for the check, or if it was just pieced together from rejected action scenes that he didn't get to do elsewhere. But I don't think it holds up. Like, there's not, like, all that charm, even in the dialogue, all that charm that we've come to expect from stuff like the Indiana Jones movies or, you know, Riggs and Murtaugh is gone. Like, there's no, this movie is charmless, with the exception of what Billy Zane and Treat Williams and CHT and CZJ and even Christy Swanson bring to the table. There's nothing in the dialogue that is charming at all. It's all in the delivery.
All right, let's do final thoughts on 1996's The Phantom.
I cannot believe this movie was written by the guy who wrote the line, "Nazi Germany has just declared war on the Jones boys." I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's wild that has happened. I want to just give a quick rundown of what this movie could have been, as opposed to what it was. There was a rumor at one time that Sergio Leone wanted to direct a Phantom movie.
Oh, shit.
But it never materialized.
Like, when?
I would assume in, like, the 60s or 70s.
Oh. Can you imagine Lee Van Cleef as the Phantom?
He had started to write a script and scout locations. And he also wanted to adapt Mandrake the Magician, but it just never happened.
So we could have had, like, the King Features universe by Sergio Leone.
Yes.
Ah, would have been amazing.
Now, we also noticed in the credits, the closing credits of this movie, that Joe Dante is credited as an executive producer. Here's why. He, in the early 1990s, that developed a draft of the script with Jeffrey Boehm. Dante and Boehm's script was originally had a tongue-in-cheek tone, and the climax included a winged demon. However, when Paramount pushed the film back a year, Dante left for other commitments and eventually ended up only being credited as an executive producer. Joel Schumacher was considered to direct the movie, but eventually the job was given to Simon Winsor, who had loved The Phantom since childhood.
Oof. I mean, like, there are parts of this movie that look like they're good. I mean, you know, we've talked about the influences of the Batman movies on all the pulp movies. And this does feel like a post-Batman Forever superhero movie. Because, again, say what you will about those Schumacher Batmans, they made money. They made a lot of money. It wasn't until Batman and Robin that the scales really tipped. With a critical reaction. But, like, this definitely feels like a post-Joel Schumacher superhero movie, if only in the way that The Phantom is designed, and if only in the way that, you know, there's, you know, set pieces that look like if someone had, you know, dumped a bucket of Day-Glo paint and a bunch of neon on them, they could be Joel Schumacher set pieces.
Right. I feel like this movie has a lot of parts that are worthwhile, but somehow when those parts got put together, the result was just this super boring, tedious movie.
It just slow and boring. So we're 0-4 for pulp movies, Matt. This does it. We are done with the pulp movie series. We're gonna take a break and do something else fun next time, I think. But yeah, 0-4. Not a good one in the bunch.
Maybe Dick Tracy came the closest?
Dick Tracy was the most interesting and enjoyable.
Yeah.
But yeah, like 0-4. Now, if, you know, I hate looking at things in terms of like, oh, what comics should be turned into movies. But if you like these pulp characters and you want to see a story that would be like a really good movie, go read King's Watch. It's got really cool Flash Gordon stuff, really cool Phantom stuff, really cool Mandrake the Magician stuff. It's mainly the heart of it is really a Flash Gordon Phantom story. So, like, it would make a really fun movie for the King Features cinematic universe, which is something that will never happen.
All right.
We couldn't even get that Universal Monsters cinematic universe off the ground.
Yeah, boy oh boy, Dracula Untold should have remained that way. All right, that is it for this episode of Movie Fighters. If you would like to send us an email, you can do that at moviefighterscast@gmail.com. Also, Chris mentioned that he is going to revive our Tumblr. You can check that out at moviefighterscast.tumblr.com. Our theme music is by Michael Kill. Our website was designed by Sean Bogus. We will be back in 2 weeks with something special for everybody. Until then.
This has been a Kaleidos Media production.